From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm April Baer. Today, a federal judge weighs penalties for attorneys who tried to overturn Michigan's 2020 election.
The question that Judge Linda Parker continuously threw out there was, well, did you do the due diligence to ensure that there was any credibility to the claims that you were making?
We'll hear from one reporter covering the hearing. Also, a conversation with Flint poet Jonah Mixon Webster. His latest collection, titled Stereotype, takes on the inherent contradictions in how Black Americans are expected to conduct themselves. He investigates seemingly simple conversations loaded with psychological weaponry.
The history of that word can never be, you know, elided or replaced or erased. And not even the process of amelioration, that still can't erase the history.
That's coming up on today's edition of Stateside. Welcome to Stateside. I'm April Baer. Today, Flint poet Jonah Mixon Webster talks about what's happened to his city over the past 5 years.
Now, Flint is a place within the great American empire that is being treated as, it looks like, and it kind of operates like a third world country.
That's later in the show, but first, at a hearing in Detroit today, attorneys who attempted to overturn Michigan's 2020 election results are facing a judge to answer for their actions. Michigan's attorney general and several other parties have asked federal judge Linda Parker to penalize these 9 lawyers for knowingly putting forth false claims about the election. Craig Mauger covered the hearing today for the Detroit News. Craig, hi there.
Hey, thanks for having me.
We should say at the outset, Joe Biden won the state of Michigan. Donald Trump lost. This has been confirmed by vote count, by an investigation led by Republican state senators and several court rulings. Is that at all in contention here? Or we're just talking about the actions of the lawyers, right?
Yeah, today's hearing is mostly focusing on the actions of these 9 attorneys who represented a group of Michigan Republicans who in November, it was the eve of Thanksgiving when they filed their original suit, sought a ruling from a federal court in Detroit that Donald Trump actually won the election. And they supplied a bevy of affidavits and other conspiracy theories that they thought would throw the result into question. The court ruled against them. And now the people on the other side of this case are asking that court to penalize these attorneys who brought the case.
Craig, some of the attorneys, a number of them, are from out of state and showed up in video. Were they defending themselves with one voice today?
There was a myriad of voices today. I mean, one of the attorneys is a gentleman by the name of Lynn Wood, who's from Georgia. And he basically said at this court hearing that he had nothing to do with this filing. He wasn't even really aware that his name was listed on the filing. It was a very fascinating element of the hearing today. The other attorneys mostly stuck together, and their argument seemed to be that they were basing their case on affidavits that had been filed in other court cases and statements that supposed witnesses had made, and that they were trying to act in good faith to raise these concerns on behalf of their clients. The question that Judge Linda Parker continuously threw out there was, well, did you do the due diligence to ensure that there was any credibility to the claims that you were making?
And what did the 9 attorneys have to say about that? Did they say whether or not they'd much investigated the reams of information they were presenting to the court?
Their answers were all over the place. Some of the answers were, yes, we called these individuals and we talked to them and we asked them. I mean, in one case, they said, we asked the person, are you sure about these numbers that you gave us? In other situations, they said, you know, these are sworn statements that were submitted in another court case. You know, we believe that the attorneys in that court case probably did the due diligence. So we think it's fair to throw these documents out there. I mean, really, there was not a uniform answer to how they took in all of these different claims about the elections and how they vetted them. I mean, they did not present a standard for how they decided what was worth including and what wasn't.
Craig, the plaintiffs, and I'm calling them that because they were plaintiffs in the initial claim before the federal court to challenge election results. This gets a little bit confusing. But these attorneys, who are all supporters of Donald Trump, presented information that half a dozen jurisdictions in Michigan showed election day turnout over 100%. Mm-hmm. That's not true, by the way. And they quoted a guy named Russell Ramsland. Can you clue us in on who he is?
Yes, Russell Ramsland is this individual from Texas who has somehow become involved in all of these different conspiracy theories about the Michigan election. He is supposedly a security analyst of some type or another, and he has thrown out in multiple incidents information that is completely inaccurate. And in this case, he said that there were these jurisdictions that had over 100% turnout, where when you pull up those jurisdictions' online reporting, I mean, this is a public document of what their election results were, you can easily find that his numbers are way off. He says the turnout in Detroit was 139%. It was 51%. I mean, that is incredibly inaccurate.
There's a pretty good article in the Washington Post for those who'd like to read more about him that talks about his company, Allied Security Operations Group, and how it was spreading election fraud rumors before last November's election. So, Craig, who's got the burden of proof here? We've got a legal team from the city of Detroit involved, the Michigan State Attorney General. I believe voices of voters are also represented. I mean, is there any federal statute or punishment that has to be proved here covering false claims?
There are multiple statutes that are in question here, and there seems to be a differing opinions on what the threshold is for a penalty to be levied. The attorneys that represented these Michigan Republicans are arguing that the judge needs to determine that they were acting in bad faith, that they knew this information was false when they submitted it and went ahead with it anyways. Where on the other side of this, the attorneys are basically arguing, the attorneys for the state and for the city of Detroit who are on the other side of this, are essentially arguing that, hey, it doesn't even have to be that standard. We're trying to argue, they say, that these people were submitting claims that were just frivolous, that these claims were submitted over and over again, and they didn't give up the lawsuit once the claims were initially thrown out. So, I mean, they are arguing a lower level of a lower threshold for instituting the sanctions against them. And it's going to ultimately be up to Judge Parker for how she sees it. Her tone today has been definitely one that seems to be fed up with what the Trump attorneys are arguing in court. She's clashed with the attorneys. It has been an emotional hearing. And this is 7 months in the making again. So it's still going on, and it's going to be interesting to see how it ends up.
Craig, this strategy that the plaintiffs undertook appears to mimic the way that Donald Trump himself has extensively used court filings in his business dealing, which is to say, file as much legal material as possible to challenge your opponent. At some point, it becomes impossible to defend them all, and a settlement will ensue, which could be favorable to you or which could have a shielding effect, preventing anyone from finding out exactly what happened. Was there any acknowledgement among the plaintiffs of the strategy? What did they say about why they were filing this challenge in the first place?
Yes, their attorney. So we have an attorney who's working for the attorneys for the plaintiffs. The attorney for these Trump pro-Trump attorneys is arguing that all of these claims together, even if they are loosely related, even if they are loosely connected to some claim of fraud, paint a larger context of these. We have large questions about the authenticity of the election. And he is arguing that in this context, they were able to seek the relief that they wanted, which was the overturning of the vote in Michigan. But what Judge Parker is getting at in her questioning is, when you look at each of these little grains of sand that make up this castle that they're trying to assemble here, a lot of them don't stand up to any level of scrutiny.
Do the defendants have to show that the plaintiffs knowingly presented falsehoods as truth and sort of conspired, or does Judge Parker just have to feel convinced about this?
Judge Parker has some discretion here. I mean, ultimately, this is going to be her decision. The attorneys for the city of Detroit and the state have essentially focused on the idea that these attorneys for President Trump were, quote, reckless and were throwing conspiracy theories out without doing any due diligence to see if they were accurate or true. And as it stands right now, that's where most of the debate has been. Did the attorneys working for overturning the election do any due diligence? Did they look into these claims before throwing them out there? So not as much knowing that they are false, but being reckless with how they handled them.
Former President Trump spoke this week at the Conservative Political Action Conference, and he once again focused on Michigan and repeated the false allegation that there was massive voter fraud in Detroit and elsewhere. Why do you think he's still fixated on what happened here last year?
I think there's a number of reasons. One is that Michigan is one of, you know, a handful of states that he would have to prove fraud in to throw into question the entirety of the election. He doesn't just need one state's result to be changed for him to have won. He needs multiple states. And one that he's been constantly focused on is Michigan. And two, you know, this lawsuit that's in question today in this court hearing is not happening in a vacuum. Multiple of the claims that were in this lawsuit were also mentioned by President Trump. I mean, these things work together. It's not just a coincidence that this lawsuit happened and that the president has also focused on Michigan. I mean, one of the things in this lawsuit is this false claim that the turnout in the city of Detroit was 139%. I mean, it's just wrong. It's been debunked over and over again. But President Trump has mentioned the 139% turnout in Detroit. These things work together, and 8 months after the election now, and there's still debate ongoing about this vote.
Craig, Vice President Kamala Harris is in town, and she will appear at a fundraiser for Governor Whitmer. It looks like the Biden team is not taking any chances with Governor Whitmer's reelection.
Yeah, I think that's right. I mean, I think the Democrats in the state of Michigan know that this reelection bid in 2022 is going to be a fight for Governor Whitmer. Usually the party that has the White House, their candidate for governor, struggles in Michigan. So there is no guarantee with this. Biden's team knows this. They also know how important it is for their party to keep these positions of governor, attorney general, and secretary of state. When you look at these election claims, to bring it back to this, you know, there's a lot of discussion in Democratic circles about how things could have gone differently potentially with these claims if there was a Republican Secretary of State, if there was a Republican Attorney General. I mean, the Attorney General who's bringing the push for sanctions in court today is Democratic Attorney General Dana Nessel. So what's at stake here in this battleground state of Michigan? It's always going to be high until something changes, and Biden's team definitely knows that.
Craig Mauger of the Detroit News. He has a stellar tweet thread on today's hearing that includes published reporting to help you get up to speed. Follow Craig D. Mauger to find it. Craig, thank you.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Still to come, poet Jonah Mixon Webster on giving voice to the contradictions of Black life.
So in some ways, that history that still persists along with the use of this word is really kind of the thing that's causing me nausea.
We'll be back with Jonah right after the break. This is Stateside. I'm April Baer. Poet Jonah Mixon Webster is about to have a rare experience. His poetry collection, Stereotype, will be reborn this summer. It came out in 2019, published by Asada Press. And this month, it's coming back, published by a much larger imprint, NAAF. If you've never read Jonah Mixon Webster's poetry before, you're in for a totally immersive experience. His writing tackles rough experiences without pulling punches, using dynamic and imaginative forms of his own device. And he's with us today to talk about Stereotype. Jonah Mixon Webster, welcome to Stateside.
Oh my God, thank you so much, April.
It's a pleasure. Hey, the very first poem in the collection is called Invocation of the Sacrosanct. And it's, I just love the way you put this together. It describes a ritual naming some stereotypic things that some people associate with Black men, articles of clothing, things that people might wear.
Find 6 stereotypical tokens of Blackness for the body. An article for each. Head, neck, wrists, ankles, feet. For mine, I chose a 5950 bang to the back, a Jesus piece, a Pelly Pelly with a fur collar, a 4 platinum watch with a bracelet, and a pair of Tims. Now, accompany the tokens with 2 intoxicants, one to drink, one to inhale. For mine, I chose a 50 Remy Martin.
And it calls upon phrases that, you know, that are sort of part of a stereotypical archetype, certain movements and behaviors. It's almost like you're describing a performance art piece or some kind of social practice.
Mm-hmm.
In asking us to partake in the ritual, it feels like you're inviting us into the things that the ways in which people sometimes expect Black men to be performative, especially white people.
Yes.
And then there's and then it wraps up with this line.
Stop. Now, write a poem that will raise you from the dead.
Hmm.
This feels like a ritual you've performed a few times.
Isn't that obvious?
Yes. I don't know.
Yes, yes, it is. Actually, like that entire ritual was taken through just my own kind of, you know, identity formation, you know, and the ways in which I was performing these same stereotypes that I thought I should, you know, adopt, or I should, you know, be presenting because I'm a Black man, right? And in a lot of ways, they were the performances, these were the rituals that kept me alive. It wasn't the poems, mostly. And so trying to subvert or turn, you know, kind of my my identity and the way I perform it around, right, and kind of get towards the thing that's going to make me more of my authentic self, you know, it's kind of having to bump up against this futility, right? Like, can a poem do that, actually? Can a poem keep you out of the grave? It's kind of odd how you're kind of taking upon these stereotypic performances that have been, you know, kind of traditionally passed down as ways of survival, but they are inherently precarious, right? And so,
I'm sorry to interrupt. Do you mean they sort of make you a target? Things like wearing a hoodie and Timberlands or being loud and boisterous in public?
Yes, yes. Yep, so they make you a target for multiple, would-be assailants, I guess, I would say. And so, and it both interracially and intra-racially, right? You become a target within both camps. And that was one of the kind of ambivalences I wanted to kind of explore and think about, especially when we get to that poem. You know, the ritual tells you to do all these things, you know, act a certain way, dress a certain way, right? But then the poem is then actually telling you to then think and reflect on what these things are and what's happening in these moments.
There's another poem a little bit later in the collection that I just really loved. It's called "The Ghost of Richard Pryor Made Me Do It." Let's listen to a clip.
Like any night, a white man sees me, seeing him, seeing me. I am again dead awake to the modes of awareness. And it was as if him seeing me meant seeing me naked, Black, obviously Black, ostensibly Black, meant seeing me. And you know what I mean already. I mean, you know, I was probably wearing something real Black, like something blacker than Black, something like a Black hoodie with a Black V-neck under it, a Black snapback, Black jeans and Black shoes. And seeing me and seeing me and all of this meant he knew I was Black. And I mean, real Black, naked Black, obviously Black, ostensibly Black, and within proximity Black still says, "Hey, give me a cigarette," to his white friend with me in earshot chose to say, "Yeah."
This poem describes making eye contact with a white guy. Mm-hmm. And first of all, feeling hyper aware of just being seen. Mm-hmm. And then going on to overhear the white guy use the N-word to a friend in a way that Black people sometimes use in a conversational way with each other.
Exactly.
And you can tell reading the poem, first of all, just how wildly inappropriate that action is and how the word is being made into a weapon with the white guy daring you, almost daring you to call him out for using it.
Yeah. And daring me to do even more. Yeah. That really happened. Yeah. Yeah, that was not out of my imagination. Yeah, that experience was so surreal. You know, of course, I've grown up hearing non-Black people use the N-word to various effects and for various reasons, various purposes. But this instance, I was just so caught off guard. And like you mentioned, so starkly aware of the position I was in. And I think that's when really it kind of made me realize what that word makes you feel as a Black person when it's coming out of the mouth of someone who's non-Black. And we get to that point, like, as if saying it meant seeing me naked, right? That is the feeling, you know, seeing me naked Black, you know, as if saying it meant seeing me naked Black, obviously Black, ostensibly Black. Mm-hmm. And that's when the times, you know, in my actual real adult life, I had to explore, you know, what's the actual power of this word, you know?
Mm-hmm.
I thank you for bringing that up, though. A lot of people don't talk about because, you know, I use the N-word a lot throughout the book, you know, to recontextualize and decontextualize, you know, some of its meaning. But I call it a conjure word, right? You conjure mm-hmm. something up when you use it. And that experience conjured up the ghost that ultimately made me, yes, I what happened in the poem happened in real life. I did end up choking the man with his own shirt.
You did?
Yes.
I wondered. I couldn't quite tell if it was a revenge fantasy or if it was also pointing out that there's a level of rage that is not realistically available to black men in a lot of circumstances.
Yes, that's exactly. And, it, you know, it was in real life, what actually happened was after he says, like, come on, what you gonna do? What you gonna do? And, you know, N-word, you know. And then so I kind of cocked my fist back and he cowers. And we all laugh. Everybody in the bar laughed. And then he kept going again. And he kept calling me the N-word over and over and over again. And that's when, you know, so like this merge or this kind of, you know, mixture of the comedy, the hilarity that was there, but that anger that was there, that was a real tense contrast for me. And so, and literally going from laughing at, you know, at him kind of cowering at a faint punch, you know, to then, you know, egging me on even more and then having to literally choke him. And I mean, and what really happened, I asked him, who's the real N now, right? Even in displays of humor and displays of anger, you know, that stereotype, that, you know, that image of the stereotype, the angry black man or the black buffoon, right? Are the two things that I'm constantly, you know, kind of toggling between. And since it did happen in Peoria, Illinois, and I already have this affinity for Richard Pryor and the way he's critically and, you know, comically interrogated, you know, these race relations, I just kind of thought it was fitting.
Yeah. If you're just joining us, my guest today is Jonah Mixon Webster. His poetry collection, Stereotype, publishes this week on Knopf Publishing Group. The second part of the collection actually begins with a knockout quote by the writer Sadia Hartman. It reads, "We need to consider why the sight of suffering so readily lends itself to inviting identification. Why is pain the conduit of identification?" It feels like that gets to a lot of the stuff that you're saying in the poems about, you know, wanting to have this life outside of trauma, outside of rage, outside of violence that one does not choose, but then also the need to talk about it.
Yeah, exactly. And there's some kind of futility that I think, you know, black people are constantly struggling with, right? And it's literally because of these stereotype formations of identity. And just the stereotypes that have been levied against black people throughout history. The infantilizing, you know, you're too underdeveloped. You haven't, you know, matured enough, right, to understand. But there are real violences, right? There are real traumas. And they do really inform our identities. And so it's like, no matter as much as we might want to slip outside of that or go beyond it even, we still have to contend with it, right? And I think that's some of the double consciousness work that W.B. Du Bois talked about. It's the self-same question that Sadia poses. It's like, why does pain so readily lends itself to invalid identification? And I think, even though these are rhetorical questions, I think, right, especially in the context of you know, what Sadia Hartman might also say as, you know, black people having to live the afterlife of slavery, I think it's just to make us ponder, right, what is it also about human nature, right, that asks us to identify pain or to identify with pain, or what has it, how have we been socialized to identify ourselves by the pain we go through? And those are questions that black people have to always, you know, answer and presume, right? And we could even go back, right, to some other historical elements where, you know, black people were thought to not feel pain at all. Even like this kind of what I call like the phantom limbs of the Phantom Limb kind of experience, 25 million black people were lost, even probably even more through, you know, the transatlantic slave trade and through the Jim Crow eras and think Reformation, things like that, right? And so I don't want to refer to them as like their phantom, like, kin, right, in the body of the black collective. And, you know, it's like to still feel that pain. To still, you know, to go to like the EGI and go to the Peace and Justice Memorial in Montgomery and look at the hanging boxes and know that they represent people who were actually hung, people who were actually lynched. To go to the Legacy Museum and then think about, right, and that pain. I'm like, that was some immense pain that I cannot explain to you, right? But I know that it has marked me, right? I know I'm marked by it.
There are a couple of poems here that suggest sexual awakening that is extremely harsh, maybe even a sexual assault. But there's also another one in here called On Juking with Another Black Boy. And I want to play the recording of it from the audiobook. Do you want to set this up at all?
I would. I would like to set this up. This piece is dedicated to a fellow queer poet, Dinez Smith. You know, a lot of folks might know them. And I credit Dinez for kind of bringing me into a fuller sense of who I am on the page. Meaning, I think when I first like saw Dinez perform or do a poem, I think one of the first poems I ever heard from Dinez was Twerking as a Radical Form of Freedom. You know, the sheer authenticity and the unabashed delivery and approach to Dinez's work really inspired me to put myself out there as authentically as possible. And so this piece was dedicated to them after we had a nice dance session at a party in L.A. or Seattle.
When I walk towards you, I am an awkward thing. Up top, too thick, too lanky. On bottom here, I might whine too slow or too fast. Forgive me if I give you my own beat to break to. If you smite me in the revel of sudden sweat and the ghost of it coming off. Now, let's call what our bodies do next a prompt. Do not pardon the grind, the almost fall, the almost fail of my thighs boomed heavy with laugh. There is a switch. There is music I can no longer name. There is an ache in my middle throat as I sang in Foss and you heard it. You hummed it too. Let the sound gape to land on my chest. Let its light flit in the moon rush. At that moment, you call my arms a gate to any room. And I say, our touching is the birth of some star we couldn't see.
That's my guest, Jonah Mixon-Webster, reading On Juking with Another Black Boy from his poetry collection, Stereotype. Jonah, what kind of relationship would you say you've had with presenting and performing your work?
You know, that I was firstly inspired by watching Deaf Poetry Jam back, I think, when I was a teenager, around like 15, 16 years old. And that's what really set me off as far as seeing that, you know, well, number one, you know, poetry has always been this, you know, oral practice, right? You know, and it's always has had that kind of performative embodied sense into it. But seeing what was happening on Deaf Poetry Jam with people like Sheehan and Saul Williams and Perry Shelton, I was like, wow, the energy this all built up and knotted up inside of me can actually finally, you know, be expressed, you know, with language and also with my body. And so, but it was not until I went to Eastern Michigan University, and I can be completely, you know, open and honest about this. My time at Eastern Michigan University, a brilliant program, a brilliant creative writing program. I was exposed to different types of artists, different types of performance artists, conceptual type artists, you know, even black artists and black poets who I've never heard of before, you know, Latasha Diggs and in the Black Took Collective and Douglas Kearney. And, you know, so I'm like, wow, there is a range of approaches to when it comes to presenting and performing what's on the page. And it doesn't have to be as static or it doesn't have to be as monotonous as some genres of performances have been when in contemporary poetry, you know. And so I really started to find a way I can incorporate the sonic performance, the embodied somatic, you know, energy, the nervous energy, the sadness, the joy. Like, how can I actually express that, right? Language can't hold everything. It can't. And the affect that, you know, that it requires, that energy that it requires to, you know, to create affect, to create the thing that moves other people, it has to be dynamic. It can't be, you know, too still. It can't be too quiet always, you know. It has to find resonances with people. You know, we all take information in different ways. And so that's why I started just trying to toy and find, you know, what was the best way I can communicate with different people with diverse sensibilities, diverse palettes, you know, whether it's visual or sonic palettes, you know. And so that's how I started, you know, trying to find different avenues and different performances. And also just to enjoy my voice also too, you know, because we always have that disembodied, you know, dissociative kind of relationship with our voices in this way.
Yes.
We're like, I sound like that, you know.
We have to take a short break, but when we come back, we'll continue my conversation with Jonah Mixon Webster. You're listening to Stateside. This is Stateside. I'm April Baer. Let's continue my conversation with Flint-born poet Jonah Mixon Webster. He has a poetry collection called Stereotype that's being republished this summer by Knopf. The third section of the book is a poem. It's a one-word poem.
Mm-hmm.
And before we talk about it, could you read the title? Because it's kind of unusually titled as well.
Yeah, all my titles are so strange. But yeah, so this piece is Black Existentialism Number 8, Ad Infinitum, or Ad Nauseam.
So this is a one-word poem. And the word is the N-word.
Mm-hmm.
But it's very creatively presented. Could you describe, for those who can't see the book right now, what they would see if they were looking at this?
Definitely. So this, and this iteration of it in particular, is, I think it's a like 18-page, or I might say 18-panel spread. You open up the poem, and on the two pages that you open up to when the poem starts, it's just the N-word, N-I-G-G-A-S. As you turn it, what we start to see is the S's begin to multiply, almost like when cells split apart.
Yeah.
Right? And that's how we start to kind of see and then engage with the word in its totality. It's these split, fragmented images of the S. I was really toying with some gestalt principles of, you know, background, foreground, individual parts, the whole. So what happens is the S's actually start to create an image of a Cuban link chain.
The image of the words on the page is as much of the experience as the poetry itself. Did you do the design of this for the printing?
Yes.
How did this come to be a part of this writing for you?
That's a great question. It actually came from a prompt from my now very close friend, who was once a former instructor of mine, Will Daddario, gave us this prompt in his poetry, philosophy, and performance class to write a one-word poem. And so I was kind of thinking conceptually. I'm like, you know, a one-word poem has to be conceptually tight. It has to conceptually make sense, right? The title and the word, they're going to be doing most of the work. But I also want to take it a step further. I'm like, what about a one-word poem that doesn't end, as the title of this piece might suggest, right? So the ad infinitum, thinking about, you know, the Latinate conversion of to suggest something that goes on and on and on forever, forever into eternity. Or the ad nauseam part, which is something that goes on and on and on forever until the point that it makes you sick. And so those two contexts, I was kind of imagining, you know, that the N-word occupies, right, both of those spaces. Something that will go on and on and on forever. No one will stop using this word, right?
Mm.
But the other coin, the other side of that coin, rather, is that there is a little bit of a sickness that might come up, right? That yeah. You know, that ambivalence, right? You know, the history of that word can never be, you know, elided or replaced or erased. All right. And not even the process of amelioration that Black folks have done to change, right, the pragmatic use of that word, that still can't erase the history. So in some ways, that history that still persists along with the use of this word is really kind of the thing that's causing me nausea. And I think might actually cause a lot of us nausea if we, you know, really just sit and think about it, think with it.
The fourth part of the book, well, let me just say, you're originally from Flint.
Mm-hmm.
And the fourth part of the book is a series of writings and poems all about Flint. And the first part is a nonfiction narrative. Why did you decide to start out with that? Did you feel like you needed to get the story of it straight in your head?
Yeah, it's a little bit. So I imagine this fourth section of the book to kind of be a, how can I say this, a kind of a cinematic, really, really immersive experience, meaning, you know, I wanted this to feel like a little bit of a movie, just in the sense that we're having to imagine and picture this apocalypse of the first world, as I refer to it, the Flint water crisis. I call it the apocalypse of the first world, right? Now, Flint is a place within the great American empire that is being treated as, it looks like, and it kind of operates like a third world country. To go from a food desert, they're closing, you know, they've closed a bunch of grocery stores around here, to an actual desert, to where, you know, now the water is poisoned and tainted, right? Making people sick and killing people. Mm-hmm. I knew that in order to really give the full experience of what it's like to live in that condition, it had to kind of feel like a movie or even maybe like a video game. You know, where you have to kind of explore this world or go through this world and you pick up little information here and there, or you have these little experiences that help to further contextualize the reality that you've been placed in.
Yeah. There's a poem called Breach that gives us a sense of the water crisis not as one thing. You know, if you just look at it from the outside and read the news accounts, you might think, oh, there was this one day the water got turned on and then one day people got poisoned. But Breach really gives us the sense of an ongoing, unfolding nightmare.
March 25, 2014, a water main has broken at an unspecified location. August 16, 2014, tests confirm the presence of fecal coliform bacteria in the tap water on Flint's west side. A boil water advisory has been put into effect.
When I was doing the research for Breach and looking up how many water main breaks were happening throughout the city during this time, even leading up before the water crisis and after, it was astounding to realize how bad the system itself was, how bad that infrastructure was, to have it be exacerbated and compounded with this policy decision that threatened the lives of like 100,000 people. It just kind of further drives home that the notion that, you know, we don't know what's going on. Even people who live here didn't know what was going on. Or we didn't have all the pieces staged in front of us so we could put the whole picture together.
One of the things I really appreciate about it, too, is that you do give us a full picture of what it is like to live in Flint, not just in the context of the water problems. Mm-hmm. But the noise pollution, mm-hmm. there's a really wonderful piece called Incubation that has reportage of everyday life and then interrupts itself with this sound of a burglar alarm that will not stop going off. Sounds like in the middle of the night, right?
Yes. So this was, I pretty much call it like a type of psychological warfare. Right across the street, actually from where I'm at right now, still, right across the street was this abandoned kind of projects. And every night for over a year between 10 p.m. and 8 a.m., when people are supposed to be sleeping, this loud, loud, I call it a sound installation. I don't even know if it's an alarm. It seemed like a sound installation because I'm like, what alarm, you know, doesn't ever go off?
This lasts for a year, despite complaint. Another day starts like this, stretched by the mile of voice sounding off from the intersection of Pearson and Clover Lawn, throwing itself to the undead which lay some distance elsewhere, the broke record of it, in the air, in the water, in the dream. Warning. Warning. You have violated an area protected by security. The authorities have been notified. Leave immediately. Warning. Warning. You have violated an area protected by security. The authorities have been notified. Leave immediately. Warning, warning. You have violated an area protected by security. The authorities have been notified. Leave immediately. Warning, 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 warning.
And no matter, you know, like no matter how much we complain about it, every night for over a year, this same sound.
The thing that just knocks me out about this poem is it brings home what it would be like, what it is like to hear that in your own home.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
You're in your home and you're being told you don't belong
exactly.
here. You need to get exactly. out of here immediately.
Exactly. Exactly. And to some instances, you know, because that section deals with the, like one of the kind of the undercurrents of that section is the survivor's guilt that I was, you know, struggling with because I did leave or I had already left. I think I started my PhD program in August of 2014 in Illinois. And so I left like 4 months after the water switch happened. When things started coming out in the news, it was like, oh God, like, how could I leave my family behind? How can I be away from my family when this stuff is happening? How can I be away from my city when this stuff is happening?
Yeah.
And people were telling me not to come back. Like, don't stay where you're at. We need you to stay in school. Oh, sorry.
Mm. I'm sorry.
I'm sorry. But
Jonah,
yeah,
Jonah, I'm sorry.
Rough.
I didn't mean to take places you didn't want to go with this.
Oh no, it's fine. No, this is great. It's fine. It's just real. It's just real, yeah. You know, just real life. But yeah, that was, and all I could do was write, pretty much.
Yeah.
All I could do was try to learn as much as about what was going on back home as I could and try to create this work that could accurately do justice to everything that was happening.
If you're just joining us, my guest today is Jonah Mixon Webster. His poetry collection, Stereotype, publishes this week on Knopf Publishing Group. As I mentioned, Stereotype came out a couple of years ago on a regional press, and this is going to be the second publication. Were there things that you were able to change or things that you wanted to change when you republished?
Great question. Yeah. I felt like I had to get the book closer to some of that, you know, I wanted to make it even more immersive, right? Or I had to find other angles, right, to incorporate in there or other pieces that maybe got cut out of the first version because either I just didn't think they worked or for whatever reason. I also wanted to, keep telling the story of the Flint water crisis and resistance, as I call it, because I think when the book leaves off, when it first was published, I think the story stopped in like 2016 as far as like the crisis was concerned. And so to try to catch another 4 years up or catch up, you know, I wanted to do that. Right. So people can kind of see and understand like, you know, it is ongoing. All right. I think people also like to, they have this misunderstanding that since you don't hear about Flint in the news that much anymore, that is not a problem. But people still don't know that they're still replacing pipes. It's 2021. This thing started in 2014. It's still not done. So I had to get that in there. But I'll be honest, I think one of the biggest changes or the biggest, I think, additions for me, in addition to the what I added to the Flint section, was this kind of blues aria.
It's a series of poems that reach in and sort of grab a fundamental truth of blues music, mm-hmm. that in part it is a reaction to Black death and Black suffering.
Mm-hmm. Oh, it was so strange. I had already written or had a blues piece or had two poems in the book that kind of referenced the blues. But I didn't have like the traditional blues forms in there. You know, in Black ontology, Black as if always, the blues, we actually are witness to a tragedy. What's being pretty much alluded to and described as a lynching. But at the very end of this depiction, what we get is the person that has been lynched has now been forced to entertain the crowd. with a song. That was this, you know, this metaphor for the much larger kind of circumstance where Black people have endured or have had to, you know, experience all this great trauma, this great suffering, and still have the burden and the responsibility to entertain the masses or to present or produce beauty in the world.
Well, ain't nothing to do but hang around. Ain't nothing to do but hang out. If I could, I'd run right straight out of town. Don't even need me shoes, just feet on the ground. I ain't nothing to do but hang around. Ain't nothing to do but hang around. Ain't no news to think about. So I'm telling you later, I'm telling you now. Ain't nothing to do but hang around.
What was interesting is that, because, you know, even though the poem ends off with, you know, and give everyone a song, there wasn't a song in there yet. And just serendipitously, I happened to meet Danny Boy Stewart, who was a collaborator, former Death Row Records artist. And I was like, oh, what song should we do? What song should we do? And then a blues song has to come out. So those, I don't think that those songs and that blues aria would have come together like that if it weren't for the chance encounter, just kind of talking and then going back and having to, you know, look at what points in the book that was already written could then open up to new work.
And it make me cry. Said I tried to buy some love, but the price too high. My change too low, had to sell my mama ring down at the store. Oh, why? And it made me cry.
Jonah, you have such a complicated relationship with these tensions within writing and expression. Do you feel like you're in a good relationship with your writing these days in terms of writing for yourself and writing for a wider world?
Yeah, that's a good question. I think, so I can tell you one thing. I experienced this when Stereotype first came out and I couldn't write anything, or like I just couldn't do it. I don't know, like the something about the process of writing a book or even rewriting a book, it takes so much out of you. I tell people all the time, and I'm not even joking when I say this, like Stereotype almost killed me to make. It took a lot to have to go to these places, like literally and metaphorically and figuratively, right, to go to these places that this stuff comes from, right? I had to put myself in these precarious positions. Right. I had to, you know, follow the stereotype through. I had to sit with a lot of stuff and cry and hurt and mourn and grieve. And I had to find a way out of it. There's definitely a fatigue that came through and that's kind of still here a little bit. I think once Stereotype has not let me go. I think Stereotype just it was like, listen, this is not how I'm supposed to be in the world. I can't let you go from this project until it's really ready, until I'm ready. I'm really what I'm supposed to be in the world. And I think that Stereotype will now kind of, you know, release me a little bit and I can continue to go along with some other writing projects that I'm really feeling great about. I don't know. It's like that writing for myself. I don't know if I would ever believe that's what I'm doing anymore. I already feel like the things that I've written, even the very personal things that I've written, Stereotype, that doesn't even belong to me anymore. Those experiences don't even belong to me. They're for the world now and for others to hopefully, you know, find their way out or their way through.
Jonah Mixon-Webster's poetry collection Stereotype publishes this week. Jonah, thank you so much for talking with us. We really appreciate you bringing us along for the trip.
Oh, thank you so much. This was a dream interview. Thank you.
Support for arts and culture coverage on Stateside comes in part from the Michigan Council for Arts and Cultural Affairs. And that's our show for today. I'm April Baer. Thank you so much for listening. Back at you tomorrow.